Okay, welcome to Our Lady, Queen of All Saints Catholic Church, Back to Basics series. For most of you in here know me already, but there, I see a couple of new faces. So for those of you who don't know, my name is Nick Jogno. I am the Adult Formation Coordinator here at Queen of All Saints Church. This is the last Back to Basics session for this season. We will have new season coming up in September of next year, and I'll have that announcement in the bulletin sometime in the middle of summer for all the classes that will have come up. Tonight, we're going to take a closer look at the Shroud of Turin. If you don't mind, before we begin, though, I would like to begin with a prayer. So, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Dear Lord Jesus Christ, despite our sinfulness, you chose to descend to us and to take upon yourself, the punishment due to us. By your passion and crucifixion, you reconciled us to God the Father. By your power as Lord of creation, you rose to new life on the third day, instituting a new creation. And by your resurrection, you've called us to new life with God the Father through and in you. We thank you for this image that's on the cloth. Whether or not it is a true sign of your death and resurrection, it provides us an opportunity to meditate on the mystery of your sacrifice. Rather than speaking to us only through our eyes and minds, let us allow this image to speak to us through our hearts, and may it affect in us a true conversion toward your merciful heart. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us. Okay, so I didn't do any original research. I did not go to Turin. I have not seen the Shroud with my own eyes. I've only seen it, like most people, in documentaries, in books, in magazines, and of course on the web today. You can get absolutely stunning pictures on the web that you can find. But for those of you who are interested, there are two really good books that I would recommend. One book, Unlocking the Secrets of the Shroud by Dr. Gilbert Lavoie. I'm recommending this one in particular because it's available for free in the public library here in Ville Platte. So rather than having to go out and buy a book, it is an excellent book. He is a medical doctor, and he does examine the medical evidence for the Shroud, and he does a really pretty good job. It's easy to read. He does not get into a lot of technical jargon, but it's really easy to read. The other book, which is called The Shroud by Ian Wilson, this guy Ian Wilson is like, if you believe in the Shroud, that is the image of Jesus, the real thing, he's the guy to go to. He is really the one responsible for a lot of the historical background, because one of the knocks against the Shroud is it's only been around since the 1300s. And he's done a lot of research to show that there's very strong evidence that we can trace it all the way back to the beginnings of Christianity. So if you're more of a historical bent rather than scientific bent, this book, The Shroud by Ian Wilson, and it's fairly new, I think it was reprinted and with new information in 2012. There are great websites that are out there. The Shroud of Turin website, the first one that's at the top is the oldest one. It's put together by a guy named Barry Schwartz. Barry Schwartz is a Jew, and he was the photographer whenever in 1978 there was an examination of the Shroud that was allowed for a team of scientists to come in. He, as a Jew, was the photographer, and he believes that it is the Shroud of Jesus Christ, the actual real one. And why he doesn't convert and become Christian, I don't know. He's never given an adequate answer for that. But he says, nope, look, I think God, his answer is, I think God is using me as a Jew to bear witness to the truth of this cloth. I don't have a dog in this fight, right? So, but he believes that he was the official photographer, and he's been running this website since 1998. It's actually older than Google. So when he first put his website out there, you couldn't even Google him because Google didn't exist. The rest of the websites that are out there, if you want to know more about them, let me know and I can get you the links if you want to get on the internet to go look up more stuff. There's a great documentary some of you may have seen called The Real Face of Jesus. It is an excellent documentary. It's available on YouTube that you can watch right on YouTube for free. And it's the one where the guy takes the information and he makes a 3D computer model of Jesus. And it's a good documentary. It's excellent. Probably I should have just played that for you tonight, but there we go. All right, so I know this is a little bit small, the text, but where do we get the Shroud in the Bible? Because the word in the Bible is actually a bunch of different words. They do use some words. Of course, the word Shroud is English, but there's a word called Sidarion, which is the word that indicates the piece of cloth that you wrap someone in. And in fact, in Latin and Italian and in French, we still call it by that same word, Sidon. For the Shroud of Turin. But we see that in Matthew, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus took the body, Jesus' body, and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud. Now, this doesn't mean, like, for example, when you go to buy your clothes at Walmart, you know, you might have to look for a shirt on the rack that somebody hadn't put their grubby fingers all over, right? And you're like, wait a second, that's a cute shirt, but they got a stain on it. It's not that kind of clean that we're talking about. The clean that's listed here is liturgically clean, right? Because the Jews are very big on having things liturgically clean. So this was a linen cloth that was liturgically clean. It also, because of the quality that we know, it was an expensive cloth that he bought. It is, by all indications, this is really kind of cool, the cloth that Joseph of Arimathea bought probably at the temple, because you remember you had buyers and sellers outside the temple. Probably he bought it at the temple because he was a member of the Sanhedrin. Was a cloth that was fit to wear for the high priest. So there was a certain cloth that the high priest had to wear whenever he went into the Holy of Holies. And it had to be made of a ritually clean material. And that's almost certainly what this is indicating. That Joseph of Arimathea bought a cloth fit for the high priest to wear when he went into the Holy of Holies. Oh my goodness, it's giving me goosebumps right there to think about that that's what Christ was wrapped in when he saved us. Offering as priest and victim the sacrifice. Then we get to John. There are some other mentions. I'm not going to go through every mention. The other two gospel writers, Mark and Luke, pretty much write the same thing. They're called the synoptics. And what you read in one, you kind of can read in the other. So I'm going to skip the other two mentions and go to John. It was the first day of the week. Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. That's John, the one who's writing the gospel. And said to them, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they laid him. Peter then came out with the other disciple and they went toward the tomb. They both ran, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. So John, being younger, sprinted out there and he waited for Peter. This is interesting, right? Why did he wait for Peter? That's a whole different talk. But anyway, so he stooping to look in, he came and saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb, and Peter saw the linen cloths lying in the napkin, which had been on his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but rolled up in a place by itself. So right now, we're clearly saying there's more than one cloth that's in there. So there is a cloth that wrapped the body, and there's at least one other cloth that was on the head, the napkin, and there's another cloth that was a binding cloth. Okay, so we're talking about multiple cloths that were in the tomb. The Shroud of Turin, which we're going to look at tonight, is one of those cloths. What are the others? Okay. We're not going to get into the other stuff because this would be a 5-hour presentation rather than a 1-hour, 45-minute presentation.
Well, they found all the other cloths. Found?
We believe there. I will mention one of the other cloths. I will mention one of the others, but I'm not going to get into it. So, then the other disciple, that's John, the guy writing the gospel, the other disciple who reached the tomb first also went in, and he saw and believed, for as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Now, this is really interesting. What did John see and believe? Whatever John saw in the tomb caused John to believe that Christ was Messiah, but it's not the resurrection. Because we're clearly told that whatever he saw, he believed. But they did not know the scriptures that he must rise from the dead. So John walks in and he sees something that the lights go off in John's head. And it's not just that there's no body. So what is it that he sees? That's a mystery. Now, what people who believe that the cloth is real and authentic would say, he saw the image of Christ on the cloth, right? That could only be what he saw. But he doesn't say that specifically. Whatever he saw, light went off. I mean, come on. There's no body in there. Somebody could have stole it. Just because there's no body doesn't mean automatically he rose from the dead. It could have been taken, right? So he saw something in there. So the Shroud of Turin. Here is an image of the whole thing for those of you who don't know. The Shroud of Turin. And do you mind, would it be okay if I turned out the set of lights up here? Here's the shroud right here, and if you can barely make out,
here is a face right here, and then we've got two arms that come like this with the wrist that meet here. And then the back side is the back. So he would have been laying flat, his back would have been here with his feet over there, and his head here. And then this side of cloth would have folded over so that this would have touched his face. That's how the shroud went. Okay?
Said the head and the arms are down here. How can that be his back?
So if you imagine that this is laying flat on a table, yeah, and you put a body, his back will be touching right here, and then this part of the cloth folds.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I got you. I'm sorry.
Over like that.
I got you. I'm sorry.
Now the image is really interesting. This has been made so that's a little more contrast, so that you can actually see it a little bit better. The image. But for everything that I've read, you can't really see the image that was such a light image. It's unbelievable. And the closer you get to it, it disappears. You can't really see the image until you step back from it. It seems to fade away is the description that's used the closer you get to it. Kind of an odd thing, okay? So I just want to bring up that in AD 325, so we're going back to the very beginnings of Christianity, so we're just, you know, a few generations after the apostles, Pope Sylvester I declared that the holy sacrifice of the Mass has to be celebrated on a cloth of linen consecrated by the bishop as if it were the clean shroud of Christ. Now I want to bring that up because, if I can get my wife to come and help me. This is a altar cloth from Queen of All Saints Church. I would normally be on the altar. I have permission to. Okay. So this is it. I want to open it up because it's about the size that the shroud would really be. But it's clean, of course, and it has no image of Christ on it. The other thing before I unfold it is, I want you to notice this size because I'm going to talk about the shroud is kept folded a certain way. And this is basically the way the shroud was kept folded in its ancient history. Okay? So we're going to unfold it. So you can see how big it is. Right. So this is about, I didn't get a tape measure and measure it, but this is pretty close to 14 feet long and 3 feet wide. So you can see that there would have been enough cloth to lay a person on it and then fold it over like a sandwich. Like a Jesus taco. Is that wrong? Should I say that, dear God?
You're fine.
All right, so.
You know, it is raining outside.
It is raining outside. Be careful, all right? So this is about how big the real shroud is, okay? And every altar has a cloth, whether they're all 14 feet or not, I'm not too sure. It depends on various altars. But they all have to represent the shroud. That's what that white cloth hanging represents, is the shroud of Jesus that he was buried in. Okay? So the sacrifice of his death and right there is represented on the altar on a burial cloth. They represent it. Alright, so now this next picture, this is the one that if we really want to see what it looks like, this is what it looks like. This is when you take those of us who are old enough to remember, and I see a bunch of young people in here, so y'all probably don't remember this. But back in the day, you had to take a picture and then go get it developed at Walmart and hope they didn't lose it, right? Because then it was gone or whatever. You dropped it off at Eckerd. Yes. And dropped it off, and if a week later it was going to come back to you, and you got the negatives, right? Well, this is interesting that when we finally were able to get photography, back in 1898 for the first time, so a little bit over 100 years ago, it was photographed for the first time. And the guy who photographed it, when he developed the negative, he was blown away. He almost, at that time, the negatives were made on glass plates. He almost dropped the glass plate because he saw the face of Jesus. He could not see it on the cloth that well. But he developed it, and on the negative, we can see the face of Jesus a little more clearly down at the bottom. So here we see, once again, now these have been enhanced a little bit just to make us be able to see it a little bit better. But we can see on the one side what it looks like on the cloth, and then on the right-hand side we see in the negative version. So the cloth has photo-negative capabilities. Weird, you know, kind of a weird thing. Lots of weird stuff. So the cloth is 14 feet by 3.5. It contains a ventral and a dorsal image of a man apparently scourged and crucified. It's a controversial cloth. Because some people say that it is the actual burial cloth of Christ. And scientific evidence shows it is not a painting. It's not a painting. But no one can explain how the image got there. What is it if it's not a painting? And so, another thing that makes this controversial is, how old is the cloth? And there are two sides. Those people who obviously don't think it's the burial cloth of Christ say it's only about 700 years old. And other people say, well, no, it's much older than that, and we can show it. So there's disagreement. So it's a controversial cloth, because there's a lot riding on this cloth. You know, there are those people who will say Jesus never existed at all. But if this is authentic, going back to the first century, and there's a guy crucified with a crown of thorns on his head, that sort of says, wait a second, this Jesus guy might have been real. So some people who do not believe in God do have a lot invested in debunking the cloth. On the other hand, people who believe in Christ sometimes feel they have a lot invested in proving it really is. Now, what we should hope is that our faith does not rest on a cloth. So if they came out in the middle of this speech, somebody rushes in and says, Nick, Father Guidry says, stop it, it's a fake. We know it. I would stop the presentation, and it wouldn't make me lose my faith in Christ at all, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not something that should ever cause us to believe, but it is something that can help to support our belief, okay? It could be a support. Historian John Walsh said this about the cloth. It is either the most awesome and instructive relic of Christ in existence, or it is one of the most ingenious, most unbelievably clever products of the human mind and hand on record. It is either one or the other. There is no middle ground. That's it. That's what this boils down to. Now, so what am I going to present tonight? I am going to present tonight support for the authenticity of the shroud. I am not going to really get into evidence saying why it's not the shroud of Jesus, okay? If you want to go and look that evidence up on the websites, I've got websites that you can go and look for. I happen to personally believe that it is the authentic burial shroud of Jesus, and I'm going to point to some evidence that suggests that I'm not crazy for believing it. That it's at least reasonable to believe that. It's reasonable to believe that. Now, I told y'all that there were some various cloths that were in the tomb that were found. One cloth I am not going to talk about is this cloth. This cloth is called the Sudarium of Oviedo in Spain. This cloth, we know, goes back for sure to the 700s, without a doubt. It has an historical record getting to Spain from the 700s. Why is this cloth important? This would have been, if it's real, the napkin that would have covered Jesus' face. You know, when there's an accident and, you know, somebody's been killed, we always like want to cover the face up, right? So we don't see the face of somebody, and Jesus' face had been beaten. So a napkin was placed on his, a cloth was placed on his face when they were taking him down from the cross. Why is this important? Because this does not have an image of a face, but what it does have is blood, sweat, and other bodily fluids that have an exact correspondence to the Shroud of Turin. If you lay this cloth on top of the face of the Shroud of Turin, you will find that the liquid marks match up. The blood matches up, the bodily fluids match up, the sweat matches up. So we know if the shroud is not made in medieval times, then it's got to go at least back to the 700s, because this cloth and the shroud had to have been made at the same time. Now, does it go back further than the 700s? Does it go back all the way to the time of Christ? I'm not going to get too much more into the Sudarium of Oviedo, though, just to say that. So let's take a look at a timeline. So here we are today, you know, right here. And so this is where we have the known history of the Shroud of Turin, the known history. And so you can see there's a huge period of time, a gap, between the time Jesus was crucified and the time that we know that this cloth is the cloth we're talking about. So we have a gap of 1,300 years. What was this cloth doing for 1,300 years if it's the real cloth of Christ? This is where the problem comes in on the cloth. It's the provenance. Where did it come from? How did it get there? And this causes a lot of historical problems for the cloth. Now, it's called the Shroud of Turin. So some of you may know that Turin is a city where that star is. Today it's in Italy. It wasn't always in Italy, but today it's in Italy. And so the shroud has been in Turin for about 500 years. It's been in Turin. So because that cloth has been there, it's called the Shroud of Turin. Okay? Now, it had other names that I will show you before that time. It hasn't always been called the Shroud of Turin. So in 1355, we know that the cloth that today is in Turin, that cloth in 1355 was shown in Leary, France. And so we can track from 1355 to today that cloth. Before 1355, things get a little murky. Now, it did not belong to the Catholic Church for almost the entire history of the cloth. It wasn't until 1983 when the last king of Italy, who was the Duke of Savoy, the place where Turin is, when he died, he couldn't be king anymore because the Italians said, we don't want a king. After World War II, they said, no king, no king, no king. So he was without a throne. He was in exile, but it was his, in his personal possession and in the possession of his family before him. And it had been inherited through the years. So when he was going to die, the question is he going to pass it on to his son? And he decided his son really wasn't the kind of guy to give this artifact to. So he bequeathed it to the Catholic Church in 1983. Pope John Paul II was pope, so it's been since 83 that it's been in the possession of the Catholic Church since that time. Okay? Now, one of the theories that's out there that people say, in fact, I heard this theory, on the news just recently, is that this is a product, a piece of art, and Leonardo da Vinci did it. Because he was doing all kinds of stuff. I don't know if y'all looked into da Vinci. He was making helicopters, and he was making all kinds. He was doing all kinds of stuff, da Vinci. Man, was unbelievable. And so some people said da Vinci came up with this. He did it. It's brilliant. Here's the problem, though. Da Vinci was born where that red arrow goes. And we know that the shroud has been in place since 1355, so there's no way Da Vinci went back in time unless he made a time machine. He did lots of stuff. I don't know. So maybe he did. I don't know, but I doubt it. So it wasn't Da Vinci. We can say that. But the biggest thing against the shroud, the biggest knock is that in 1988, there were scientific tests done, and scientists, of course, are never wrong. Ask all those who said we're going through a period of global warming. That has stopped. It's been 10 years that the planet has stopped warming. But anyway, we're going through a period of global warming. So in 1988, there was a sample of cloth that was cut off the shroud to do dating, C14, carbon-14 dating. And three independent laboratories took their samples, and they all came up with a range of between 1260 and 1390. In other words, they said, dating the Shroud of Turin, it was only about 700 years old, and so consequently, this nonsense about this being the Shroud of Jesus, you can stop all that, because it's not old enough. And you'll notice the date that they came up with does fit into the possible timeline that we know the shroud was in 1355. It fits that timeline, okay? So the carbon dating range falls here. And look, right in the middle of the known date that we know the shroud exists, bam, it coincidentally falls right in the middle of that date range. Case closed, right? The shroud is a fake. Got to be. That's the big news. It's not real. Except the people who really did believe the shroud was real said, wait a second, that's not right. There are some reasons for us to believe that that carbon dating was inaccurate. Not that the scientists were wrong. The scientists did their work and they came up with what they came up with. But the piece of cloth that they were given was not able to be tested accurately. And there are some reasons for believing that that's true. One reason is the piece that they took, that they cut, this was a huge fight to get the piece of, can you imagine cutting the shroud? Like, you believe that's the shroud that buried Jesus. I want to cut a piece off of that, right? So there was a huge fight over where are they going to cut the piece off of? And it wasn't until the scientists all came to the Turin Cathedral where it's being housed. Remember, the church doesn't own it. Well, yeah, at this point, the church didn't own it. So the guy who was in charge of the Turin Cathedral, he did not want to have it cut, but permission had already been given by the Vatican to do the test, so you had people going head-to-head. And the guy in charge of the shroud was like, I'm not letting y'all cut it. And the other people were like, but your boss said we could do it. And so up until the hour before the actual pieces were going to get cut, they were negotiating where are we going to cut it from. And the place where it was cut was a poorly chosen place. And the second thing is, not only was the sample a poor sample, but we have historical records that show that there's no way that that it could be correct. There's no way. But let's look at the sample. Where was the sample taken from? If you look at the photograph, what do you automatically notice about that place where it was taken? Does it look like the rest of the cloth? No, it looks like a piece added on, right? Because it is a piece that was added on. It was taken from a place where over the centuries it was held. I want you to imagine my wife and I, y'all saw us stretch this thing out, and we had to both hold it from a corner. You don't hold it from the middle, you hold it from the corner. And so all of the people who had been holding over the centuries were holding the shroud from that corner. Here we have artists' renditions going back over the centuries showing the public exhibition. Where is he holding? The corner where the sample was taken. Samples were taken. Here's another. Different time that it was put on display. Here we've got holding from the corner where the sample was taken. Here's another image, holding from the corner where the sample was taken. What does it have to do with anything? Because when the priests, the bishops were holding that corner, they were actually contaminated. They didn't know they were going to be carbon dating done in 1988, right? That never occurred to their mind. But they were contaminating with their own personal DNA and sweat and everything else. Plus, the sweat, can you imagine wearing everything that a cardinal and a bishop wears? Full gear. And most of the time, when this was on public display, was during the Feast of the Assumption in August. You're sweating. St. Charles Borromeo wrote how he was embarrassed because he was holding it and the sweat was just pouring off his face, pouring on the shroud. And one of the people on the side of him were like, dude, watch out, what you doing, man? Sweat somewhere else. You know? So there's even question, can the cloth be properly dated? Considering all of the pilgrims who've come up to kiss the cloth, artists who would make copies of the cloth and then touch their piece of art to the cloth as a way to maybe kind of bless their piece of art. So is there even possible, is this even a good candidate for carbon 14 dating? And the answer is, there's reason to believe it's not a good candidate for carbon 14 dating. Now, in addition, historically, we know the shroud dates from at least 1195. Without a doubt, we know that it does. How do we know? Because of those holes. Now, let me go back for a minute so you can see where the holes were. So this is what it looks like without my little circles. And then we're talking about some little holes that occur right here. They are called poker holes. Nobody really knows how the holes were made. But it looks like if somebody took a hot poker and poked a hole through the cloth. Now, it was folded. Remember how I had the cloth folded? So what would happen was, you'll notice that we can clearly see right here and right here the holes. But as we get here and here, the holes become less pronounced. Because whatever burned it, burned the top layer because it was folded. And it burned the second layer and a little bit the third layer and barely burned the fourth layer. So this is one of the clues that we know how the cloth was folded. Because we can look at burn marks to see how it was folded. Now, what does that have to do with telling us that it was 1195? How can we tell that by some burn holes? Here's how. Well, that's just a close-up view of the burn holes. So, here's how. In Hungary, a manuscript at a monastery was found. Now, these are all handwritten manuscripts, right? No printing presses back then. And the guy who found this manuscript sitting somewhere, his last name was Prey. That was his last name. So we call this document the Prey Codex or the Prey Manuscript. And this thing was made in 1195. We know the year that this thing was made, in 1195. And so we want to take a look at something. Look down at the bottom where we're going to be able to see the cloth folded over. I'm going to make it a little bit bigger. So as we look at this, two things about this. You're going to see right here that L-shaped hole, and we know this represents the cloth because of the pattern. The cloth was woven with a very expensive 3-to-1 weave called a herringbone weave. It's a very rare weave in linen cloth. And it's a weave that was practiced in first century Palestine. And in 1195, the artist who drew this saw the shroud with his eyes. And when he saw the shroud, we know it because of the herringbone weave, he saw the poker holes. So in at least 1195, that cloth that we call the shroud had already in it those burn marks in 1195, documented right there in the Pray manuscript. And so where does that put us? Oh, I'll get to that timeline in a minute. In addition, there are some other burn marks, just so y'all know there was some heavy fire that happened. The smoke from the fire is also going to be a problem for dating the shroud, because all of the smoke is going to put carbon into that cloth. And the more carbon you have in something, the younger it appears. Right? And so, forget about the fires. You would, man, y'all think Father Guidry uses some incense? I don't know. But back in the day, they didn't spare any expense on the incense, and they were incensing this puppy up like this, right? And so they were getting that cloth full of incense every time they had it out in presentation. So this is really not a pretty good candidate. I'm going to get to the timeline again in a minute, but Jesus' hands. Another thing that we want to look at are Jesus' hands. Does that look a little weird, the way his arms and hands are right there? That's kind of an odd, you know, if you're an artist and you're going to draw somebody laying down, are you drawing them all like crossed like that? You know, probably not. Why would you draw that? That doesn't look comfortable. You want to make Jesus uncomfortable? I don't know. So we look at his hands, and the other thing, not only the position of his hands, but there are no thumbs. Why did the artist go about drawing him like he's a character in The Simpsons with only 4 fingers? I don't know. No Simpsons. So, let's take a look at the cloth.
You died for that lightning bolt, aren't you?
So we'll take a look at the cloth. This is the part that we're zeroing in on, and I'm going to kind of turn it around up and down. So we'll see right here. Here are the hands of Jesus. And you'll notice 1, 2, 3, 4 fingers, no thumb. 1, 2, 3, 4 fingers, no thumb. On the Shroud of Turin, there is no thumb. We're going to, we'll talk about the wound in a minute. So there's no thumb. Okay, I'll go ahead and talk about the wound now. I'll go ahead and talk about the wound because it does touch on the thumb. So, most of you have seen crucifixes with Jesus and the nail is put like in his hands, right? Okay, now that's not accurate. Whenever the shroud was put on display about a century ago and people were taking pictures and were like, oh my goodness, look at the picture of the shroud. And so a doctor named Dr. Pierre Bourbet from France said, I want to investigate this. And he had access to cadavers, and he did some experiments, hanging cadavers up with big nails. And putting them through the hand would just tear right off. There's no way to support somebody through the hand. So the representations of Christ being nailed through the hands is not accurate. But where you can crucify somebody is through this part of the wrist. And it can come out the back of the hand back here. Now, in Hebrew, the word for hand actually includes everything that we would call the wrist and the hand. So in Hebrew, if he was crucified in the hand, it could have been still in the wrist. Now, what else is important about the thumbs is that when Dr. Barbet found that when a nail was driven, there's a particular hole right in the middle of the hand that makes it really easy, and the Romans were good at doing this because they did them by the hundreds. And so they knew exactly where to put this. And when you drive a nail right through this part of the hand, it cuts a nerve, the nerve that controls your thumb. And so when the nail gets driven, automatically your thumb gets pulled in. So this cloth shows an astounding knowledge of the details of a crucifixion, the anatomical details of a crucifixion. All right? So that Pray manuscript shows Jesus with his hands crossed like this and no thumb. So we know that the Pray manuscript is referring to Jesus, and the Pray manuscript, the Pray Codex, is already earlier than the carbon 14 dating. So even if you want to say, oh no,
carbon 14, that sample was a good sample. Okay, no problem. How do you deal with the Praecodex? How do you explain its appearance hundreds of years before the carbon date? Okay, so on 2 counts, we can discount the carbon 14 dating and show that it wasn't accurate. Okay, now, what was it doing then? Where was it? There is a cloth that makes its appearance through history. And the cloth goes by 2 names. It goes by the image of Edessa, which is a city, and it also goes by a name called the Mandili. And this cloth contained an image of Jesus described by the people who saw it hundreds and hundreds of years ago as not made by human hands. That's how they described it. So there is some cloth before the known history, some cloth with an image of Christ on it that has made its way through history. And so I want to take us now through the history of that cloth. Because what Ian Wilson and other people who support the shroud believe is that cloth called the image of Edessa or the Mandilion is in fact the same cloth that we call the Shroud of Turin. Okay? So, now, here is a cloth, and I want to just pull this out again. This is what the image of Edessa or the Mandilion look like. It's not a whole body, right? Not a whole body. Because when you fold that cloth up like this, unfortunately, I don't have a face of Jesus, but if I could have had the whole body of Jesus on this, and I folded it up this way, the only part of Jesus that you would see when it's folded like this would be his face. And this appears to be the way that it was put in public. For hundreds of years, it wasn't unfolded. At least not publicly, maybe privately for the bishops and other important people. But when it was presented in public, it was presented folded like this, and the only thing you would have seen is the face of Jesus. Now, which brings me to something else that I was asked about a while ago, and that is something called Veronica. Veronica's veil. Right? Y'all know the story of Veronica? What happened with Veronica?
She wiped Jesus' face.
She wiped his face, right? And so there's supposedly a cloth that's got the face of Jesus on it. Veronica's veil is that. The name Veronica comes from 2 words. Vero icon. Veronica is vero icon. Vero means true. That's what the word vero means in Latin, true. And icon is the Greek word for image. So Veronica actually means true image. Now, when it's displayed, the real thing is displayed with only Jesus' face. And artists have an opportunity to see it, and they don't get to see the whole cloth. But an artist, or somebody, he's not even an artist with his tools, he's just somebody who's like a pilgrim, and he's seeing it, and he goes and tells other people, or he finally gets to his paints, what's he going to paint? He's going to paint a cloth with just a face. And so now you've got this cloth with just a face being reproduced all over the place. And so people are like, what is it? Well, that's the true icon. It's an image of the true icon, Veronica. And so that image becomes called Veronica's veil because people didn't realize how big it was. So we have some positive reasons, like negative, like carbon 14 dating is a negative reason. It's a bad thing. Carbon 14 is wrong. That's a negative reason for believing it's old. But there are some positive reasons for believing it's not a medieval piece of art. Scientific positive reasons for believing it's not a piece of art. In 1978, do any of you remember this in 78? A team of scientists was sent. These happened to be Americans. They asked permission from the owner of the shroud, who was King Umberto II, they asked him, can we go and study the shroud? And he gave permission. So in 1978, there was going to be already scheduled a public showing, a display of the shroud. And so they said, we want to go then. And they said, okay, you got 100 hours. And so they brought a team of top scientists, people who worked with NASA, people who worked with the military in some of the research and development departments, people who brought their knowledge and expertise for 100 hours around the clock. They didn't study. They worked in shifts so that they'd be able to take advantage of every single minute. And they examined, actually 120 continuous hours. So they did
This is when it happened, just so you can kind of know when we're talking about. It happened right here, right about in that timeline. Okay.
So, and here's what they said. This is from the STIRP team report. This is from the group of scientists using cutting-edge technology. They even used a machine that NASA used for examining the moon's surface and the surface of other planets. This is how sophisticated their equipment was. And this is their finding, scientific finding, not the church. None of these people were church people. They said, not even all of them were Catholic. And you had a Jew on there. So he wasn't even all Christian. They said, no pigments, paints, dyes, or stains have been found on the fibers. X-ray, fluorescence, and microchemistry preclude, eliminate the possibility of paint being used as a method for creating the image. Computer enhancement and analysis show that it has unique three-dimensional information encoded in it. And we conclude for now that the shroud image is that of a real human, scourged and crucified. It is not the product of an artist. The blood stains are real blood composed of hemoglobin and also give a positive test for serum albumin. Now, the one thing about the blood, this guy, Barry Schwartz, the Jew, he was on edge about believing if it was real or not for a long time, for over a decade, maybe close to two decades. He wasn't sure. And he was talking to one of the world's leading blood scientists, a guy who studies blood, whatever you call those people. And so,
hematologist,
that's it, hematologist. And so the guy, Barry Schwartz's problem was the blood was so red. You know, dry blood turns brown. But this blood was like red. It wasn't brown, it was red. The blood that's on the floor. And so he's like, how can that blood stay so red? And in talking to this hematologist, that guy said that when a person is placed under extreme stress, violent stress, that the body produces an enzyme called bilirubin, which sets the red blood cells, and so they keep their red color rather than degrading. So the fact that the blood stayed red gives further credence that whoever died had to have died a violent death in order to get the blood to stay red this long. And that's when that guy Barry Schwartz said, that's it. I believe it now.
Did they type the blood by any chance?
They did type the blood. The blood is typed AB positive. It's the exact same blood type as every other known Eucharistic miracle that has been tested. It's also the same blood type that's found on that Caesarium of Oviedo.
What do you mean Eucharistic miracle that's been tested?
So, like, for example, if there is the precious blood, then the chalice, the wine, that becomes the precious blood, and then it actually becomes blood. Or sometimes the host, the bread that has become Jesus' body, actually turns into flesh. And so in those instances, like, for example, at Lanciano, Italy, mm-hmm. they've typed that miracle.
A positive.
AB positive.
AB positive.
So, so how do you get that, you know? How do you get that? I don't know. So here's another thing that's really cool about the blood, and it is that the blood, which we can see those dark spots, or the blood spots, by the way, and the image is bad. It doesn't look too red here, but it's whatever. So the blood came first. So I want you to think about that. If you were going to draw a crucified man and then put the blood where he was beaten and nailed, what would you draw first? The blood or the body? You draw the body first. But the blood came first. And the reason why we know that the blood came first is because underneath the blood, the image doesn't exist. So there's no image, and the blood stopped. Whatever caused the image was prevented from being formed because the blood was on top of the cloth right there already. So some artist would have to have put blood and then come back and drawn the body around it some kind of way and make it match anatomically correct. That would be a little difficult. The image is not paint. Instead, where does it come from then if it's not paint? It comes from a discoloration of the fibrils of the thread. So now I want you to imagine a thread, a linen thread. A thread is several smaller pieces of fiber that are less than the diameter of a hair wound together. It is only one fiber deep that the image goes. So imagine, it's not one thread deep. It's one fiber deep that the image goes. Where two fibers cross, the image is on the top fiber and not the fiber underneath.
So, if you were going to paint this, which there's no evidence of paint, but if you were going to paint this, you would need a paintbrush the size of a human hair or smaller and paint it fiber by fiber. So it's a little bit hard to believe. Now, so what makes it show up then? Well, some of you interested in the news, who read the newspaper and remember seeing these pictures in the newspaper, you know that newspapers are printed in a kind of a print where there is no spot over here is darker than any other spot. This is a bunch of, here's what this looks like up close. As we get closer, it's a bunch of what? Dots, right? And every dot's the same color. Every dot's the same color. Well, why does it look darker right here in her eye? Why does it look darker? Because there are more dots grouped together. Not because somebody applied a darker dot, but because there are more dots together. So this is what the shroud is. Where we see the shroud, the image just happens to be where there's a greater concentration of those fibers that are discolored. That's the only thing that makes it there. And so here's a micro. This is on the nose. This is the darkest area of the cloth, which is the nose. And this is, as much as you can see, all the individual fibrils. And so you can see that this is this color here, but directly underneath, and I don't know if you can see where y'all are at, directly underneath it, it's white.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's only one fibril deep.
Is that deep as it goes?
So, another thing that's pretty interesting about the cloth is that it's a photographic negative. And this is before photography was invented. So the image on the right is the image that's on the cloth itself. That's what you would see with your naked eye. And then when a photograph was taken of it in 1898 for the first time, when the negative was developed, this is what the negative looked like. So it was astounding to actually see the face so much clearer than what you normally see on the cloth. And we read a while ago that it contains 3D imaging. So there was a device that was used by NASA that was used to do their scientific studies. V8 image analyzer is what it was called. And when they ran it over the cloth, that device looks at shadows and darkness of an image, and it produces a 3D effect. And so the shroud does that. Now, we've thrown painting out, right? So it's not painting. Because there's no paint, one fiber deep. So the other theory for the shroud is that it was really a photograph. Somebody in the 1300s invented photography. And they actually made a photograph, primitive, but they made a photograph on the shroud. And there was a guy who tried to prove that this was true, and he did make one. But he did it with all modern technology. Now, let's imagine somebody brilliant 700 years ago was able to create a camera and photograph something. And it worked. And then he would say, oh, great, I made a photograph. Well, I guess I'll go back to the fields today. Oh, well, he'd keep making photographs, right? So we do not have, if somebody made a photograph to produce this image, then why are there no more examples of that? There will not be photography invented for another couple of hundred years.
Other than alien technology.
Alien technology, I guess we can't discount that, right? But furthermore, even if this were a photograph, even if it were a photograph, there's a problem. Because photographs do not produce 3D imaging. So there go. Even if you want to imagine somebody came up with a camera, Obscura it's called, back in the day, you can imagine it, but it won't have 3D imaging. Somebody took the 3D imaging an artist did, if you watch the Real Face of Jesus documentary, and using the information encoded in the shroud and their imagination, they created what this face would look like with a computer. Does that what the face really look like? I don't know. Remember, this is using information and an artist's imagination. Right?
People put around them with a phone.
There are certain limitations on the computer.
Another thing about the thorns is that when the Romans crucified people, they didn't put thorns on all their heads.
No, there's only one person we know of.
That was unique to Jesus.
Right, yeah. Only one person we know of. So here's what we do know. The shroud represents an authentic representation of what a scourged, crucified man might have looked like, including a cap of thorns. Which, by the way, according to the shroud, it's not a crown. The
the wound pattern on the shroud is not like a band that just goes around the head like this. It's more like a cap that would have been put right here. And so there are puncture wounds that come here and here. So it's more like a cap than a crown. The scourge marks on the back, so this is a little bit of enhancement so that we can see the scourge marks. The scourge marks on the back show a pattern matching known instruments. So all of these little, you can see, they're like always two little dots everywhere. This is the kind of instrument that the Romans used. Whoever made, if this is an artistic interpretation, then they had to have known exactly what a scourged man looked like, including the instruments that Romans would have used. We talked about the nails going through the wrist and folding the thumbs already. Crown of thorns. It's got the side, the wound that's in the side. That's also there. Now, other information, scientific information. So on the shroud, this guy right here, his name is Dr. Max Free. He took some tape. It's kind of like super duper scientist scotch tape. And he put it on the shroud to collect the pollens and the dust that was on the shroud. And when he examined it, now I'm going to tell you this bit of information is controversial. Not everybody agrees that his findings were accurate. But some people do agree. But this one is more controversial than the other stuff so far. What he found was that there was pollen on the shroud from France and Italy, which we would expect because we know it was in France and Italy. But there was also pollen from Cyprus and from Asia Minor, which we call Turkey today, from Syria, where the city of Edessa that I'll talk about is located. And there's pollen that's found only in a 10-mile radius of Jerusalem. So whoever's going to fake this went and collected pollen from all these areas and put pollen on it. Okay? Not just pollen. Dust samples from under the feet. So where the feet are, they collected dust. And the dust sample is from a kind of limestone that is found in ancient tombs in Jerusalem. So this is some serious forgery that's going on, right? Billy Cannon maybe should have taken lessons. I'm not Billy Cannon, y'all know.
He's a friend of mine.
All right. So maybe he should have taken lessons from whoever forged the shroud, right?
I'll tell him you said that.
Let him know I said that.
He'll come looking for you.
That's okay. You know what? You shouldn't have done the Quran. All right. So what about related to Jewish burials? Does the shroud represent what it was like for a Jew to be buried? And the answer is absolutely. There's a book from 1969 by Maurice Lamb, and it says, for a burst, so here's the deal. Why was this so bloody? Right, because Jews are very ritualistic. He would have been cleaned, right? How come he's so bloody? It can't really be Jesus. Can't really be a Jewish guy. Except, here's the way Jews still do it to this day, according to the stuff that I've read. And that is, when a person dies a violent death, the body is not washed. Any blood that comes out at the time of dying is called life blood. And it's ritually impure. And you do not clean that up. And wherever a person dies, they stay in their clothes. You do not take their clothes. Their bloody clothes don't come off. This is the way Orthodox Jews did it in the first century. And the way they still do it today. Okay? Now, so, but wait a second, though. Jesus didn't have any clothes on. You just said, take all his clothes off. Ah, but you remember in the scripture, what did the guards do? What did the centurions do? They drew lots for his clothes. Right? So, they drew lots for that. They played the gambling for it. So, they took his clothes. He was not wearing his clothes when he was on the cross. He was naked. And so, there's no reason why we should expect to see a clothed Jesus on the shroud. In fact, you should see him not having any clothes. Okay? So just to get just another picture, just to kind of give you an idea of how that would have happened, he would have been wrapped right there. And so the shroud shows a man who was heavily scourged, beaten around the face, fitted with the crown of thorns, crucified, punctured with a spear while he was already dead, and buried in Jerusalem according to Jewish customs. Who does that sound like? Obviously, it sounds like Jesus. So the shroud shows evidence for... Or rather, against the shroud, so it being a fake or a forgery or an artwork or an artifact or whatever, you got C14 dating that says the date, and then you got, wait a second, we only know about this since 1355. So two things are counting against it. But you know, in a court of law, you got to look at all the evidence. And so there's some other evidence that's in favor of the shroud. We know it's not a painting. We know it matches historical facts about crucifixion, location, and Jewish burial customs.
So, which side outweighs the other? And now, we're at this point of the presentation that if you want to be excused, you can be excused. But I'm going on. All right, Phil. Last one's here.
Actually, for your presentation, the court of law, criminal court.
Okay.
It's proof beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Shadow of doubt.
Civil proceeding. It's a
preponderance of the evidence. And this would be like a civil.
Civil duty.
This would be like a civil duty. All right. So, let's get to the historical thing, that Mendelian. Okay, I don't have that much left. Let's get to the Mendelian. So, we know absolutely it was in Europe at this point. Disputed history. We believe it was in Edessa right here. There's pretty very strong proof of that. And Constantinople right here. Now, I'm going to tell you, for me, this is a problem area. Because we really don't know anything before the third, fourth century. So where was it from the time of Jesus' crucifixion up until we get to Edessa? That part's really unclear. But if you accept that it's really the shroud of Jesus going all the way back to Edessa, well, it's not that much further of a step to figure out that it probably goes back further than that. All right. So here we see the image of Edessa, or another name for that is called the Mendelian. Once again, that's the name that was given, or I'm saying is the name given to the same cloth that we call the Shroud of Turin. And as you look right here, you're going to see this is a cloth. That's a long cloth, and there's a face on the cloth, and this guy's leaning down to kiss the face on the cloth. It's being presented to a king, King Abgar. And so it's being presented to King Abgar, and he's looking at the face on this cloth. So we know that there was some cloth with a face on it that goes back that far. So where are we talking about now? Turin's over there. We're going back here to Edessa. Jerusalem's where Jesus was crucified. Antioch was the first Christian city. This is where people first got called Christian, was in this city. Huge Christian center in Antioch. And so Edessa is just a little bit further than Antioch. Antioch is where Peter was bishop first, and then Peter went to Rome. So Peter was bishop in Antioch, leading the church in Antioch, and then he goes to Rome. So I'm keying in on that because where was the shroud before Edessa? It almost certainly was in Antioch. We just don't have any documents saying that. That's 100% pure speculation. All right? So we have a legend, tradition, that says that during the first century, St. Thomas the Apostle sends a guy named Adai, which is another name for Thaddeus, which is another name for St. Jude. So there's a tradition that says that St. Jude went to this Edessan king, Abgar, with a letter from Jesus. So this guy, King Abgar, says, "Hey man, I've been hearing about this guy, Jesus. And I want to write to him because I'm a little bit sick and maybe he'll come heal me." So Abgar writes a letter to Jesus, and Jesus writes a letter back saying, "Look, I can't come right now. I'm a little busy over here, but I'm going to send you somebody with this image of myself." And so when it gets sent, now this is legend and tradition, right? Okay. And when it gets sent to Abgar, Abgar is healed and he becomes a Christian. Okay. Now, that's legend and tradition. But the thing is, behind legends and tradition, there is usually some basis of truth. And the trick is teasing out what's the basis of truth and what's not, and what you can discard. Okay? So, Edessa does convert, as we do know, here's the truth, Edessa does convert to Christianity, and it does convert under a King Abgar. But not Abgar the Fifth, Abgar the Eighth. Okay? By the way, that's St. Jude, right? Anybody ever wonder what St. Jude's holding all the time? That is the face of Jesus that supposedly he carried with him to go to King Abgar. That's why he's holding that medallion. Okay? So the traditional iconography of St. Jude, even though we weren't aware of it, but we've seen St. Jude, that's what that picture, that circle, it's that face of Jesus. It represents, whether it's real or not, him going to King Abgar. Here's just another image of that that's brought to King Abgar, and we see the face of Jesus on it. So, according to legend, Edessa becomes Christian. Now, this was back at a time when this was brand new, right? Brand new. And a lot of people were saying that Christianity is false. It was making Jews get fired up, and they were like, those Christian people are causing trouble, and they were getting the authorities to persecute the Christians, and so it became a little bit like it wasn't too good to be a Christian. And so after the king, the first Christian king, according to the legend, after he dies, his sons say, forget Christianity, we're going back to paganism. And at that moment, as the legend goes, Christian churches are destroyed, but a relic like the shroud would have been hidden away. This is how the narrative is supposed to develop. So something like the shroud would have been hidden away. And centuries pass, and after centuries of pagan rule and no Christians, the people forget about the shroud. All the Christians have died out or they moved on. And so wherever the shroud gets hidden, nobody knows about it anymore. It's lost. This is the theory on why it, and once again, pure speculation because there's no documentation to prove it, but why the very early part of the shroud's history is silent. Because it was hidden away to protect it from being destroyed during the pagan persecutions. Okay? Now, Rome eventually takes over. Rome is going to divide into two, and we're going to get the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire, which we're going to call the Byzantine Empire. So, this part right here, we're going to start calling the Byzantine Empire. You're going to see that it's in charge of where Edessa is. So now these people are going to come into play. At this time, we're talking about the 300s to 400s, the earliest images of Christ. Y'all recognize Christ in any of those? The only way we know which ones are Christ are what? He's got the halo behind his head. He's holding a cross. He's got this chiro behind his head. It's called the chiro. And right here, he's got the halo with the cross behind his head. That doesn't look like any Jesus we know of. All of the earliest images of Jesus were of a young man without a beard. Here we see some more, and it was traditional to show him as a shepherd, right? Because Jesus said, I'm the good shepherd. So the earliest images were Jesus as a young shepherd. Young shepherd. Here we see him again. That's Jesus. Doesn't look like any Jesus we know. So what happened? How come Jesus looks like he does now?
Paul McCartney.
He didn't play the guitar. So here's now we're going to get into solid history. Now we're getting into solid history. In 525, a major earthquake hits the city of Edessa, where supposedly the shroud has been hidden for centuries that everybody forgot about. And so the city gets rebuilt. And in the rebuilding of the city, in particular, the old Christian section of the city, in the rebuilding, there's a gate where you enter, because all the cities had a wall built around them with a gate to get in. And over the gate, they're doing some reconstruction work, and lo and behold, they find an image of Jesus hidden behind the wall. So now we can. Now we're on pretty good historical footing. Not everybody agrees with this. You'll find some historians who disagree. But we're still on reasonable belief for the history right here. And this thing that's found back there is specifically described as a sidon or a burial cloth. In other words, it's not a small napkin. It's longer. And it's folded as a tetradiplon, which tetra means four. Di means two, right? So tetra. So it's folded, and then folded, and folded. So it's folded four times double. It's doubled four times. Okay? And it's described at this moment as acheropoita, which means not made by human hands. So whatever this thing that's found is, it's starting to sound like the thing that we call the Shroud of Turin in 525 AD. So we start folding it up. And then now you see where once you fold it up and you only see the head, if that's the only thing that you're looking at, is it folded up, you can imagine why people would have thought it's just the face of Jesus. Only the face. Because they can't see it all folded up. And so here's the shroud compared to that image that goes back to that time period. And from this point forward, once that thing is found in Edessa, once it's found, and it starts every now and then being put on display, from this point forward, the depiction of Jesus by artists changes. So before, where he was beardless and young, now suddenly he starts looking like this.
What were all the artists all of a sudden in the 500s? Why did they change their mind? Unless they were seeing something that's supposed to really be the face of Jesus. This is called the Pantocrator, which is an image. This is one of the oldest images that we have of Jesus in the St. Catherine's Monastery in Saudi Arabia. There's a place where traditionally the burning bush is, and there was a monastery built there by Christians when Christians kind of took over. And St. Catherine's Monastery is still there. And this image is found there, and it's an image that gets repeated over and over. So we see this, by the way.
We're going to see that there are some markings. So you see this little shape right here, this triangle? Well, that's going to be repeated. You can kind of see the triangle right here and the shape there. And we can see it right here, the shape there. So over and over, there are certain markings that when these images are being produced,
they repeat these certain markings on his face. One of them is the way you can see where he has like two little wisps of hair, and one side of his hair is kind of pulled back further than the other side, which is a little bit further out. And many times we see his beard
tends to be divided right there. And these are called Vignon markings from a guy named, his last name was Vignon, and he was the guy who said, wow, they all have these markings in common. And so they're called Vignon markings, and so they relate directly to the shroud, because when you compare them to the shroud has all of those markings. So here we see some more of it with the divided beard, with the two wisps of hair that come out. So, as we said, most people don't know that it's such a long thing because it's only displayed folded up. Then we get into trouble. And we're still in trouble today with this thing. But in the 600s, Islam sweeps up out of the Arabian Peninsula. And they're going to take over here. That's where Edessa is. Now I got a question. What do y'all know about Muslims and making images of things? Do they like that?
Y'all know they don't like an image of who? Muhammad, right? They don't like an image of anything. This is one of the reasons why Islamic art is very geometric. It's beautiful. Islamic art is beautiful, but it doesn't really depict living things. It suggests through geometric forms living things. They don't like images. And they destroyed Christian images wherever they went. Now, what makes this so interesting is Edessa comes under Muslim control. But this image is not destroyed.
What time period is that?
We're now in the 600s and into the 700s. That image is not destroyed by the Muslim ruler. Now, some Muslims were more, not they were not all like ISIS. Not every Muslim ruler was like ISIS tolerant. Some of them were more tolerant. And actually, there were some Christians who, believe it or not, lived better off under some of these tolerant Muslim rules than they did under the Byzantine Emperor at certain points. Because you actually had Christians fighting against Christians at some point. So that's a whole different story. But the point is that that image was not destroyed, even though Muslims don't like images. Why? What about that image kept them from destroying it? It's an interesting question that I don't have an answer for. Now, this is so interesting to me. In 943, the Byzantine emperor is gone. He's fighting back against the Muslims. He's lost territory. He's going to take it back. I'm on the warpath. And he goes and he wins war after battle after battle after battle. He takes city after city after city. And just wherever he goes, he's winning. There's nothing stopping him. And he gets to Edessa. He's got Edessa in his hand. He just has to squeeze and it's his. He doesn't attack Edessa. What he does instead is he tells the Muslim leader of Edessa, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you give me the image of Edessa and let me take it back with me, I will give you so much money you can't believe it. I will not burn Edessa down. I'll leave your mosques in place. I will give you 200 of your highest ranking prisoners that we have. I just want that image. Something about that image in 943 AD was so important that this guy said, I'm willing to trade everything I've got to get it. Because imagine what happens in the city if he attacks the city. What might happen to that image? It gets destroyed. So rather than have the city get attacked and then hear the Muslims, bam, we're putting fire on this sucker. He says, I'll leave the city alone. Just give me the image to go back with. Now, if this was, if he thought that this was only a painting, would he have traded all this to get it? Obviously not. So now the cloth goes to Constantinople, and it gets described as being extremely faint, more like a moist secretion without pigment or painter's art. Sound familiar? Yeah, that's the cloth we call the Shroud of Turin. But it gets a new name. It's not an Edessa anymore, right? You can't call it the image of Edessa. So it picks up a new name. The new name that it picks up is Mandylion. It's a Greek changing of an Arabic word. So it gets called the Mandylion. So the Mandylion is the image of Edessa, is the Shroud of Turin. We're saying, I'm saying. Okay? So we're going to get to the, I'm going to kind of skip over this because I don't want to keep you here too long. This is the Crusades. Christians are going to come to help get the Holy Land back during the Crusades. In 1130, there's a monk who goes and visits Constantinople, and he says that he sees a cloth called the Mandylion with the form and the size of the Lord's body to all who look on it. This is not just a cloth with only a face. This is a full body cloth. And then we get to the Fourth Crusade. So I do want to stop on the Fourth Crusade for a moment. The first crusade, or the first crusade, Pope said, great, let's do it. Let's get the Holy Land back. Second crusade, the Pope said, okay, look, we need to continue this. By the time we get to the third crusade, the crusaders are like, hey, we might better make some money out of this. And the Pope sort of backs off and says, I really don't want to have too much to do with that. The fourth crusade, the Pope actually excommunicates the crusaders for some of the stuff that they're doing. He says, y'all are doing wrong stuff. You're supposed to be going attacking the Muslims and look at y'all fighting each other. Y'all doing all kind of crazy stuff. So, during the Fourth Crusade, Western Christians go and attack Constantinople, the Rome of the Byzantine Empire. And this is despite the fact that they're getting excommunicated by the Pope to do it. They're going to do it anyway. And before the attack, a French guy says that he sees a shroud in which our Lord has been wrapped, and every Friday it stood upright so that one could see the figure of our Lord on it. And so an artist has tried to imagine what would that be. Because remember, we have this thing folded up, right? Well, if you make this cloth inside a contraption with a lever that you can turn, and you turn it, you can actually raise it. Look what happens when it's coming out of the box. Right? It looks like the Lord is rising from the dead. It's a cool little trick to make it look like the image is coming up. So that's what this French guy sees. He sees something like this. Once again, we're not talking about just a face cloth. We're talking about a full body cloth. So the Crusaders come in. They destroy Constantinople to the shame of Western Christians everywhere. This is really a terrible event. Should not have happened, but it did. And they take anything they can get their hands on. They burn stuff down, they destroy, they're acting like barbarians. And they take whatever they can get, all of the relics. And Constantinople had a ton of relics in there, including this cloth. And from this point forward, from the Fourth Crusade, nobody knows what happens to Mandylion.
Those Knights Templars.
This artist right here has drawn them as like Knights Templar, right here. But that's a false representation, because actually they weren't at the site of Constantinople. So there is no mention after this point of the Mandylion. Where did the cloth go? This full-bodied thing with the image of Christ on it, where did it go? But piecing together a sentence here, a fragment there, historians have been able to piece together a very, very possible, a realistic explanation of what happened. So, the Mandylion came into the possession of the French duke who was responsible for that section of the city. So when Constantinople got burned, you know, all the crusader big dogs, they all got a section of the city. And the section where the Mandylion was being housed was under the authority of a French duke, who later becomes the Duke of Athens, a guy named Athan de la Roche. Now, if this is true, and we have reason to believe it, then he sent it back to his chateau in Besançon in France. And there is documentation that shows that there was a cloth in the 1340s that was presented at Eastertide. Now, 1354, one of the greatest knights in French history, a guy named Geoffrey I de Charnay. He is one of the greatest. He's a true hero of French chivalric knights. Paragon of a man. He wrote a book. This is how we know like what knights were supposed to do and what they were supposed to be like, because he wrote a manual, how to be a knight. He was just top dog. And so he asked the Pope for permission to build a small chapel at his property in Liry, France. But this chapel would come under his private jurisdiction. So he would answer directly to the Pope for this chapel, not under the jurisdiction of his bishop. Would not be under the jurisdiction of the bishop of Troyes. Now, this wasn't unusual. A lot of rich people were able to do this kind of a thing with private chapels in their house. Okay? So this wasn't unusual, but nevertheless, he's building a private chapel. So why do we care about him? Because this guy is married to Jeanne de Verny, who happens to be the great-great-granddaughter of Othon de la Roche, the guy who was the duke in charge of that section of Constantinople where the Mandylion was being kept, and at whose chateau we have a record that the shroud-like object was displayed at Eastertide in the 1340s. So it is not impossible to believe that she has received this through inheritance. And so when she marries Geoffrey de Charnay, it passes into his hands as her husband. But we know this is a badge. So they had it on display. And if you were a pilgrim, remember this is back in the day when you were walking to get where you had to get. If you were a pilgrim to show up when they had the shroud thing on display in 1355, you got to buy a little souvenir. Hey, I was there, right? They didn't sell t-shirts back then. So you bought badges. And so you bought one. This is an actual one of the badges that was pilgrims could get to show that they had seen the shroud. That's proof they had been there. And what we see, of course, are both images right here. We know it's the shroud. The herringbone, we know it's representing the shroud. And we see right here the coat of arms. And this is the coat of arms for Jeanne de Verny. It's unusual that it shows her coat of arms and his separately, even though they might be married, which historians have taken to indicate that the reason why her coat of arms is put is because really her family was must have been more important in this particular event. What would have made her family more important? The shroud comes through her family. So the two coats of arms are separated. Okay? So now, I really don't have too much more to go. So the shroud stays in de Charnay's family. It's passed. So now the shroud is in that guy de Charnay's family. It's going to stay. We know it stays in his family. As a side note, the bishop. Remember, this is not under control of the bishop, right? Why should we care? Because pilgrimages were big business. If you had a relic in your church, pilgrims came to your church to visit it. And they spent their money while they were there. And so at Liry, at this guy, the Charnay's church in Liry, that's where all the pilgrims are going. They were not going to the cathedral where the bishop was. And his cathedral is falling into disrepair. And the bishop wrote a letter to the Pope saying, somebody stop this guy. He's showing some kind of a shroud that's not even real, and he's telling people it's real. So people who say the shroud's not real, they like to pull the letter out from the bishop, and they say, wait a second. You got a bishop in the church saying it's not real, brother. How come you gonna say it's real? A guy who was alive at the time said it's not real. Okay? So there is some of this conflict that's going on. But what do you make of it? Okay, there are explanations for that. I just wanted to put it out there. I'm not going to get into all the explanations of why money is the primary motivation of why you might have done it. Anyway, 1453. Margaret de Charnay ends up, she's widowed. Now, this is the granddaughter of de Charnay. She's married a couple of times and she doesn't have any children. She's alone in her old age. She needs to be taken care of. So she approaches the Duke of Savoy, Duke Louis, and she says, So she approaches him and she says, look, I got this thing right here. Can you exchange something for it, like a place to live and make sure people see about me in my old age? And so apparently an exchange is made, but it's listed on the legal documentation only as that she gave valuable services. But from this point forward now, the valuable service must have been the shroud, because from this point forward, it's no longer in her family. It is now in the family of the Dukes of Savoy. Okay? And of course, they control Turin. That's where their duchy is, where Turin is. They build I'm not going to get into all the problems. There were some more problems that went there. They build a chapel directly next to the to their palace. So this is the palace of the Duke back here. This is the cathedral. And they build a special chapel for it that connects the palace to the cathedral. And that's where it gets displayed.
And it gets displayed only a few times. Mostly it can get displayed at weddings.
So what ends up happening is the shroud ends up being displayed like four times every hundred, so like once every generation. It gets displayed once every generation. 1898, there's going to be one of these big events, and they're going to have the shroud out, and the Duke says, oh man, this photography stuff looks like it's pretty cool. Hey, maybe I can get somebody to come and photograph it for me. So he calls this guy Segundo Pia, he's an amateur photographer, to come and photograph the shroud, and this is the image that he gets when he develops his picture of the shroud. So it stays in the family of the Dukes of Savoy, and then I told y'all Umberto dies. He doesn't want to pass it to his son, so he bequeaths it to the Catholic Church. So it comes into the possession of Pope John Paul II and the popes who come after this. And then this year, in 2015, we have a public exposition that began in April 19th. It's going to go to June 24th. Pope Francis is going to be there, so probably be all over the news on June 21st. There's a much more important event happening on June 21st, though. My wife's birthday is going to be on June 21st. So I'm sorry, Pope Francis. He can't beat the shroud. So this takes us through pretty much through the end of the presentation. So what I hope that you've seen is it is reasonable to believe that the shroud is the authentic shroud that wrapped the body of Christ. There is scientific reason to believe that it is not a painted image or a photograph. There is scientific reason to believe that it was in Jerusalem in the first century. And there's historical reason to believe that it traveled from Jerusalem to Edessa, to Constantinople, then finally to Turin, where it is today. So whether it is or it isn't, the church has never authoritatively said. Pope John Paul II said, when he received the cloth, it is not within the capacity of the church to declare it real or not. That's in the capacity of scientists and historians. It is in the capacity of the church to make sure that this cloth helps to aid our devotion. And so the emphasis of the church has been on helping to aid the devotion, meditating on the passion of Christ, meditating on his wounds, on his sacrifice, and through meditating on what Christ did for us, to enter into that passion with Christ. Whether or not that image is real or not, it still has that positive effect in our lives. Okay? Do y'all have any questions? If there are no questions, thank you. Yes, ma'am. Well, there is a cloth that is in Vatican. It's only a face, and it is pretty obviously a painting. And it goes there. There's a couple of cloths, actually, not just in the Vatican. There's one that's over in the Russians. Kind of thought that they were going to be the big dogs, and in Moscow they have another copy of that too. And then a couple of other places there are some copies of this, but it's only a face. So what's in Rome is just a face. And so that's called sometimes Veronica's veil. But probably it was painted after the shroud. So it's a copy of what was seen on the shroud. So Veronica's veil is not the shroud. It's an artistic representation of what was on the shroud.
More than.
That's not, well, you know, that's a good question. That's not in Scripture, right? So if you open up sacred Scripture, that's not in there. That's something that developed over time through devotions. And so somewhere along the way, people knew that Christ left his image on a cloth. And so, but then the question became, how did Christ leave his image on the cloth? You have to understand that it would have been, for Jews, this is one of the reasons why we don't hear about it in the very early parts of Christianity. Because not only do Muslims have something against images, Jews were expressly against images. And the greatest profanation that happened to the Jews was whenever the Romans came and they set a statue up, an idol up in their temple. any graven image for a Jew would have been just absolutely out of bounds. So for the first apostles to pull out what is an image of a bloody, beaten Christ would have immediately turned off any of the Jewish people they were trying to convert. They wouldn't have listened to another word after that. They would have wanted to stone people for having an image. Forget about listening to what they said. So it would have been very difficult to convert Jewish people at the beginning with all of this. So the idea sort of developed that there was an image with Christ on it, but how did it get there? And so what began to be told to explain this image, because people really weren't too sure, right? We didn't have the internet back then, was that, oh, it must have been like, for example, the sweat of his face and the dirt when he wiped his face. So that would explain, and he was alive, and it's not really an image because he pressed it on his face. So nobody drew it. So then you could get away with something like that. And so that kind of thing starts to enter devotion.
That
brings up a whole other thing. You talked about Baptists don't like images. What we saw happening when the Muslims came through and they destroyed all the images, very interestingly, at the Protestant Reformation, the very first Protestants, where they took over, because every place was Catholic in Europe, the Protestants went in and they destroyed stained glass, they destroyed paintings, they destroyed every artistic representation. We lost the patrimony of the artistic history of the church was decimated during the Protestant Reformation. We only have written accounts of what some items existed, and maybe some artist kind of drew a picture of it on the side, so we know a thing existed, but it doesn't exist anymore because it was destroyed.
You know the three basic religious truths in the world?
The three basic religious truths?
Yeah, the Muslims don't recognize Jesus as anything but the Messiah. The Jews don't recognize Jesus as the Messiah, and the Baptists don't recognize each other in the liquor store.
Be nice.
All right. Are there no more questions? You have been a very nice audience.
Thank you.
It is an hour and a half. So if you have questions, come and talk to me after. I can answer any questions. If not, God bless y'all. And just be on the lookout for the next schedule for startup in September.
Very nice. Enjoy the presentation.
Chardonnay,
he made all that wine, too.
Oh, I promise you on his lady. Oh, those of y'all who do the Bible study, some of y'all come to the Bible study. Look, next week, please look out for the text message, because if they continue their work and it creates a problem, if they're not done doing what they need to do and they can't get into this room, I may have to find another way to do the Bible study. So for next week, those of you who come to do the Bible study, I'm going to let y'all know by Friday or Saturday at the absolute latest for the Bible study, because I just don't know what the access to this room is going to be like.